Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Grammarly. Today, people are working to innovate and do more in their workdays, but coming up with fresh ideas and quick responses can be tough. Introducing Grammarly Go, a product offering personalized generative AI communication assistance that will change the way you write. With just a few clicks, Grammarly Go can ideate, compose, and rewrite thoughtfully, accelerating your productivity and unlocking your creativity. Go to grammarly.com/go.
Hi, this is Here and Now Anytime, where we give you a little news, a little something you weren't expecting, and always a fresh, in-depth perspective on current events, arts and culture, and stories that matter. Subscribe or follow to get all our episodes out every weekday. And if you like what you hear, tell a friend about us to help spread the word. Now here's the show.
You have a Speaker of the House right now that is obfuscating his responsibility on the behalf of the people of this country. It's just not sustainable for local economies to handle this crisis, and Congress has to do its job.
Mayors, overwhelmed by the migrant crisis, are calling on D.C. for help. It's Friday, January 19th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, we'll hear from the mayor of Chicago as 15,000 migrants in the city that I live in still don't have permanent housing. And when the Kansas City Chiefs head to Buffalo Sunday, I'm sure they'll get a warm welcome from the Bills Mafia. But with another snowy showdown in the forecast, do the Western New Yorkers have the home field advantage?
Well, in this case, I'm not sure how much, because Kansas City just played in the freezing cold game the week prior. But I can tell you, when Miami comes to town, it's always exciting to know that this team that hangs out in South Beach all year has to come up to our neck of the woods and deal with, you know, our environment.
But first, Iowa's over, and it's New Hampshire's time to shine. Former President Trump has been splitting his time this week between rallies there and a federal courthouse in Manhattan for one of his many legal cases. That has not slowed his progress toward securing the bid for the Republican presidential nomination. And meanwhile, for the Democrats, President Biden's foreign policy agenda, including aid to Ukraine and Israel, hinges on whether he can get Congress to agree to a deal on immigration, possibly in the next week. Our Friday Politics Roundtable had plenty to discuss. Peter O'Dowd and Celeste Headlee were joined this time by ABC's Rick Klein and Francesca Chambers of USA Today, who called in from New Hampshire.
So, Francesca, for the GOP nomination in New Hampshire, where you are, do you think independent voters could be the deciding votes there?
Independent voters will very much be a factor in this primary come Tuesday. That is a category that Nikki Haley has been targeting as she tries to defeat Donald Trump in the state. So that everyone understands how this works in New Hampshire, undeclared voters, which make up the largest group of voters in the state, can come in on Tuesday and they can register there on site to become a Republican to vote in the Republican primary. Then on their way out, they can redeclare themselves independents or unaffiliated voters on their way out of the primary. So there are a number of people at events throughout the state that I've been to over the last couple of days who are showing up at Haley rallies saying that they are in that category, and that's what they plan to do in order to be able to vote for her, in order to stop Trump.
Will it help her, Francesca?
Whether or not she can make up the difference is perhaps another question, if it's enough. In the Suffolk Daily tracking poll today, she was down 17 points to Donald Trump still, and there's only 4 days left for her to make up that gap.
Well, so, speaking of Donald Trump, sorry, Celeste, there, on Fox News last night, he was asked what his closing argument to New Hampshire voters would be, and his answer was make America great again, but then he pivoted to the legal fight to keep his name on the ballot in Colorado and Maine, and his push for presidential immunity, despite having been charged with election interference. Let's listen.
If you take immunity away from the president, so important, you will have a president that's not going to be able to do anything, because when he leaves office, the opposing party president, if it's the opposing party, will indict the president.
And on CNN, Nikki Haley said no one is above the law, and she would only pardon Trump if he's convicted.
You know, when you talk about a pardon, someone's already been found guilty. But for me, the last thing we need is an 80-year-old president sitting in jail, because that's just going to further divide our country.
So, Rick, what will the takeaway be in New Hampshire if Trump wins on Tuesday?
If Trump wins on Tuesday in decisive fashion, he is almost certain to win the nomination. I really don't think that's an overstatement. We've never had an open primary where a candidate won Iowa and New Hampshire and didn't win the nomination. Obviously, the strength that he showed in Iowa last week was staggering. He's now only down to three candidates. Haley, if she is going to make a campaign of this, she's going to have to win somewhere. New Hampshire is her best opportunity by far. I noted that she's got the endorsement of the governor of New Hampshire. Francesca and I saw him with her just the other day, and he is downgrading expectations, saying a strong second. I don't think that's going to be good enough for her. There really aren't a lot of favorable states after that, and bottom line is that Republicans appear willing to and likely to continue to embrace Donald Trump. And if you don't win one of these early states, Iowa and New Hampshire are the best opportunities. I don't know how DeSantis or Haley gets to stop that once the campaign goes national.
Okay, so Francesca Haley, again, a Southern-born daughter of Indian immigrants, struggled yet again on a question about race. CNN host Jake Tapper pressed her about saying the U.S. has never been a racist country.
But when you look, it said all men are created equal. I think the intent was to do the right thing.
She had the stage to herself. It was a town hall last night because she refused to debate. What are you hearing about her campaign and some of the responses she's had that have been controversial?
In talking to voters about both what she said in the prior interview, which took place on Fox, as well as what she said in the town hall in New Hampshire about the Civil War, where she did not mention slavery as a cause of the Civil War, voters are concerned about it, including those independents that we just talked about. Almost every voter who I have asked about her comments over the last couple of days has said that this is an issue for her, these remarks. Now, they are saying that, of course, politicians say things that they regret or stumble on issues all the time, but they are certainly concerned that these stumbles for her in the final days could hurt her support in the state heading into Tuesday.
So those were the Republicans. Let's talk about President Biden. It kind of seems his campaign engines are revving up a little bit. Here he is yesterday in North Carolina.
Bringing opportunity and hope to people and communities across this country. Let me give you one example of bringing high-speed internet to every person.
He was talking about broadband expansion there for local communities. So next week, he and his vice president, Kamala Harris, and their spouses are going to be campaigning together for the first time since the campaign officially began last April. Rick, what do you think? I mean, I've heard some people say that the campaign has been kind of slow to get off the ground. Do you see it that way?
There's no question they've been slow to get off the ground, and I think they're avoiding the state of New Hampshire entirely, where there are other candidates running against him. He is not on the ballot. It's not for delegates, but his write-in campaign, I think, is going to be a key early indication in this primary process of where his support is in the Democratic Party. He's going to be the Democratic nominee. That's very clear. But the way that they've played this strategically and combined with the issues that are colliding on this White House, including Israel, are making for some tough sledding. And I think people are going to be closely watching how he squares up. He is, for all intents and purposes, already running against Donald Trump. But he does have primaries that he has to get through to at least gauge where the electorate in the Democratic Party is.
So Biden and Harris are doing a multi-state reproductive freedoms tour, marking the 51st anniversary of the Roe v. Wade abortion rights decision that was, of course, overturned by the Supreme Court 2 years ago. I wonder, how crucial do you think is the issue of abortion to the Biden campaign?
I think it's huge for Biden. I think between democracy and the Dobbs ruling, you're going to see a lot of messaging that hone in on these things. And we have seen now in election after election that voters care deeply about abortion rights. And when they've had the opportunity to weigh in, they do so. And right now it's an issue that Republicans are still divided on. Donald Trump has a lot that he has to answer for, as having named those justices that overturned Roe v. Wade. And we haven't seen any signs yet that the anger over the ramifications and the outcome of that Supreme Court ruling has abated. If anything, it seems stronger in some pockets of the country.
Francesca, let's touch on another issue that was sure to be big in the upcoming election, and that is immigration. Where do you think Congress will come down on that issue, plus aid to Ukraine in the next week? Because voters say immigration is concerned. Allies say Ukraine aid is critical. Biden seems to be on the brink of a deal with Senate Republicans to get both.
Immigration has been a critical issue out here on the campaign trail, particularly among Republican voters. A big debate going on over that in the GOP primary right now. When it comes to what Biden might be able to achieve with Congress, a key difficulty he faces, though, is that even if Republicans in the Senate and Democrats in the Senate come to some sort of an agreement over immigration in order to pass his national security package, it will run into hurdles, deep hurdles potentially, in the House of Representatives, where Republicans are saying that without major concessions on immigration from the Biden administration, that they won't pass either that aid to Israel in that package, at least, or the aid to Ukraine. Now, whether or not they could potentially decouple them, that's something that's been talked about all along, hasn't happened. So right now, it looks as if he's going to have to strike a deal, some sort of a deal with the House Republicans. Speaker Mike Johnson, he's in a tough spot right now. A lot of the Republicans in the House of Representatives, the more conservative members, do not want to see additional aid to Ukraine. And so he's going to have to get major concessions from Biden on immigration in order for that to pass.
And so, Rick, do you think there might be aid for Israel coming out of Congress at this point? Biden spoke with the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu for the first time in a month. But yesterday, Israel's Prime Minister publicly rejected the U.S. stated goal of a state for Palestinians. What do you think?
Yeah, and we just saw the Senate reject an effort to try to tie further aid to conditions on the Israelis. It was led by Democrats, including Senator Bernie Sanders. You know, the issue of Israel is in some ways less controversial, but it is in other ways more urgent and a bigger hurdle, and it's taken a back seat so far to Ukraine. It is going to come right back into the conversation because unlike Ukraine, this is an issue that Democrats are deeply divided on. So it's the president's own party where he may have some of his biggest obstacles.
Francesca, you mentioned the House Speaker Mike Johnson and the tough road he's got ahead of him. We haven't talked about this yet. Democrats helped him get a short-term funding bill passed last night. It averted a government shutdown later this evening. On C-SPAN this morning, a member of the Conservative Freedom Caucus, Matt Rosendale of Montana, was asked if Speaker Johnson should be worried about his job because he worked with Democrats.
I think that there are those who would take every action necessary, but I'm not in that camp yet.
Does it surprise you that Mike Johnson hasn't gotten more flack or lost his job because he did the very thing that Speaker McCarthy did, worked with Democrats?
Well, his camp has argued so far that his hands were sort of tied. Speaker McCarthy made previous deals with the Biden administration and with other members of Congress that they've been sticking to, including on those spending caps. So they've kicked the can down the road now to March. It buys them some more time to try and come up with a spending deal and come up with a pathway forward. But so far, you know, he's taken, as you noted, some scrutiny from conservatives, and some of them are very, very upset, but we have not seen the same sort of effort to oust him yet.
So, Rick, what are you watching for as we maybe try to find a permanent solution to a government shutdown?
Well, there's no way that Mike Johnson can govern without Democrats at the table. And will Republicans stomach that? The best thing he has going for them is that as much as Republicans don't want that to happen, they don't want to go through what they just did a few months ago with an ousted speaker and the chaos that followed, going on weeks without a speaker. So Mike Johnson benefits from this situation that he's in, but it is a really untenable one because I don't see any way that you can govern this majority, particularly with the narrowness of it and the absences in Congress, without relying on Democrats. And that's just going to be, it's been a non-starter in the past.
Yeah. Rick Klein is political director for ABC News, and Francesca Chambers is White House correspondent for USA Today. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
We're going to stay with immigration policy and take a look at what's happening in Chicago. After the break, Peter speaks with the mayor, Brandon Johnson. The city was already overwhelmed even before temperatures plunged below zero this week. And now the mayor is calling on the feds for relief. Stick around.
On this week's Wildcard, we talk with Issa Rae about those moments where our lives could have gone another direction.
Definitely wasn't supposed to be with that guy at all, but I still think about it.
I'm Rachel Martin. Issa Rae tells us how to make peace with the path not taken. That's on the Wildcard podcast from NPR, the game where cards control the conversation.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Carvana. With thousands of options under $20,000, plus customizable financing terms and down payments as low as $0 down, it's easy to find a car that fits your lifestyle. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today. Terms and conditions may apply.
Do you wish stories could unfold over 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? You tired of doom scrolling, trying to find humanity, or maybe a deeper understanding of why the world is the way it is? Listen to Embedded, NPR's original documentary series. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
It is well below freezing in Chicago, and shelters that keep thousands of people out of the cold are at their breaking point. Around 15,000 migrants are living in the city without permanent homes, and that is a big issue facing Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, who joined a conference of mayors this week in Washington, D.C., calling for more federal assistance on immigration. We have Mayor Johnson on the line now. Mayor, welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me, and Happy New Year.
And you too. Thousands of unhoused people were already in Chicago hunkering down for what's been a pretty tough winter recently. Now you also have thousands more who've crossed the border. They were sent north by the governor of Texas. Just how overwhelmed are your shelters?
Well, we have 27 shelters that I've stood up since taking office, 15,000 people that we are providing emergency shelter for migrants, asylum seekers. 5,000 children are in our Chicago public schools. We're providing health screenings, vaccinations, working through the work authorization process to help these families have an opportunity to have a sustainable life here in Chicago or in America. We are working to resettle families. 10,000 families have been resettled since the beginning of this mission. As you've indicated, the raggedy and reckless behavior of Governor Abbott has created a great deal of chaos. I've worked very hard to provide some structure and some coordination around this mission. But we have this international federal crisis that really requires a coordinated federal response. But local municipalities are essentially being pushed to subsidize this mission, and it's not sustainable.
Right.
And if Congress doesn't
responsibility,
this is going to get very hard.
We'll get to the federal response in just a moment, but now the responsibility is at your doorstep, whether you like it or not. I understand there's a 60-day limit on shelter stays for migrants. You've delayed the deadline for folks to leave until February 1st just because it's so cold outside. But what happens after that? Where will people go?
Well, look, this is the ongoing challenge that we have. You know, as long as we have someone at the border, Governor Abbott, who is intentionally sending migrants to democratically ran cities, and quite frankly, cities that are led by people of color and particularly black leaders, that this is going to be an ongoing challenge. What I've done over the course of my first 8 months in office, again, we are sheltering 15,000 people. We're educating 5,000 children. 53% of them are third grade or younger. And we're doing everything that we can to coordinate with the faith community, mutual aid support, the philanthropic community, our Unity Initiative, in which our faith community has stepped up to help support, you know, this mission. But this is not, local municipalities are not designed to carry out this mission. Now, I've done everything in my power that I can do to do just that, like I said, with 27 shelters, while also dedicating $250 million to our currently unhoused families. I did that in my first budget. So we are still moving to make sure we address the immediate crisis of those who are unhoused in Chicago while also responding to this this international crisis.
You mentioned the children. As you well know, a 5-year-old boy died last month at a shelter that came under some pretty intense scrutiny because it was quite unsanitary. Apparently, there were cockroach infestations, leaking sewage. People were getting sick. There wasn't enough food or bathrooms. How are you fixing that problem?
Well, when I took office, the landing zone were police districts, which was untenable, and it was, you know, obviously very much very difficult for law enforcement to do its job. And there were challenges there. I mean, there were ambulatory runs that were taking place there. People were sick, and in many instances, when families arrive to the city of Chicago, they are coming with very little resources, quite obviously, and they were coming in really, really poor health conditions. Every single issue that has been raised with all of our shelters, we've addressed them. And, as I've said before, the death of this
little boy that I've continued to offer my condolences to the family. It has been well documented, you know, that the conditions that have been raised at this facility, there's no link between those conditions that we've addressed and this boy's death. So I just wanted to be very clear that we are dealing with this crisis because it's being caused by the failure of Congress to actually act and do its job.
What's your message to Congress?
Reform.
Because you have lawmakers right now gathering, essentially as we speak, trying to make significant policy changes. What's your message here in Washington?
Thank you. I'm here in D.C. now, and it's just not just me. Thank you for that question. It's mayors all over this country that are coming together, whether they are impacted like Chicago or not. The Congress has to do its job. The President of the United States have put forth, a budget or a policy that could address this crisis. And they actually have to act. Unfortunately, you have a Speaker of the House right now that is obfuscating his responsibility on the behalf of the people of this country. It's just not sustainable for local economies to handle this crisis, and Congress has to do its job.
Brandon Johnson is the mayor of Chicago. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Coming up next, sure, there are diehard football fans everywhere. But have you been to Buffalo? After the break, Peter talks to the Bills Fan of the Year ahead of the playoff game Sunday. Put on your Zubas, and we'll be right back.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Why did Cola Scola write a bonkers, extremely fictionalized play about Mary Todd Lincoln?
Well, you know, it was 2020 and we were all so isolated. I just started doing research. But the truth is, I just thought of it.
We'll talk about that and more on Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
With NPR Plus, there's more to hear, like extended interviews with some of the experts we talk to at Planet Money and The Indicator.
It's a mistake for economists to only think about economic efficiency when considering policies, because you'll actually wind up with a worse outcome.
And with NPR Plus, you help keep NPR going. Learn more at plus.npr.org.
Why is everyone so obsessed with traditional wives or trad wives on social media? This week, we're talking about the viral videos of women making marshmallows and mozzarella from scratch, and how behind the sheen of calm kitchens and cute fits, there's some interesting pessimism about our modern world. And that's worth digging into. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
On NPR's Throughline.
We cannot function for 24 hours without cobalt, because it's in our smartphone, our tablet, our laptop. And as a consequence, the lives of the people living in that part of the Congo descended into just a catastrophe.
Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
For the second time in a week, the Buffalo Bills are asking their fans to bail them out. Another snowstorm is heading for upstate New York, and the team is once again offering fans $20 an hour to shovel snow out of the stadium before Sunday's playoff game against the Kansas City Chiefs. Now, if it sounds like deja vu, that's because the same thing happened on Monday. A crew of hardcore fans helped dig out Highmark Stadium ahead of a playoff game that was delayed a day because it was covered with nearly 2 feet of snow, which makes us think the Bills, holy cow, they have some hardcore fans, and one of them is Del Reed. He was named the Bills Fan of the Year this season, and we have the pleasure of speaking with him now. Del, welcome.
Thank you so much for inviting me on.
So let's start with Monday's game against the Steelers. Even though all those fans had come to the stadium, helped shovel out the snow, a lot of the seats in the aisles were still covered with it. What was that game like? It must have been wild.
It was wild. Thankfully, our seats were pretty shoveled out. Not ideal, but we had somewhere to put our butts. Honestly, people were tweeting even yesterday how shovelers were being invited back to help out. And some people were saying, can you please just leave the snow under our seats so we can throw them up in the air for celebrations again? Because that was really fun.
So you've got more snow in the forecast. Game temps are going to be in the 20s. How do you gird yourself to sit through weather like that?
It's funny, this is going to sound, you know, especially for listeners who maybe don't live in Buffalo, it's not a big deal. We're so used to it. We're used to 20 degree and far below. You buy the right layers, and you've had those right layers for years. I'm not too concerned about it.
Well, as far as the football goes, how much of a home field advantage does that give the Bills?
Well, in this case, I'm not sure how much, because Kansas City just played in the freezing cold game the week prior. But I can tell you, when Miami comes to town, it's always exciting to know that this team that hangs out in South Beach all year has to come up to our neck of the woods and deal with, you know, our environment.
All right. Well, forgive me for telling you something that you're very well aware of. The last time the Bills won a Super Bowl, was never. And you still got a really a slate of really good teams to get through if you want to make it that far. Is this your year?
I'd like to hope so. I'd like to believe so. If you believe in destiny, there's definitely a narrative being written here. You know, you go back 6 weeks and the team was 6-6 and people were calling for the coach's job. Imagine, I remember telling people, just wait and see how the season ends, because every year it feels like somebody wins a Super Bowl or a World Series and you hear the announcer saying, just 2 months ago, people were calling for this coach's job, and now he's a champion. That stuff happens, and so maybe it's our turn to live through that story.
Yeah, well, you were named, as I said, Bills Fan of the Year. I can understand why, which means, by the way, that you're up for the honor of NFL Fan of the Year. Why do you love this team so much?
I always describe the Buffalo Bills as being the extra family member in every household in Western New York. It's an honor to be the Bills Fan of the Year this year, but honestly, every game, there's 73,000 other people as just as deserving as I am, and that's only just the people in the stadium. A lot of people think that there's nothing to do in Buffalo because the Buffalo fans are so obsessed with the team, they think, oh, that must be all there is to do. No, there's a lot to do in Buffalo. We just really love our team. They are part of our community, and they're kind of our face to the rest of the country and the world.
Del Reed, braving the snow and the freezing temperatures for Sunday's playoff game against Patrick Mahomes and the Kansas City Chiefs. Good luck, Del.
Thank you. Thank you. This is always a stressful game when these two teams line up, but we're ready for it here.
Bills fan Del Reed, for what it's worth, his team's left tackle, Deion Dawkins, agrees. Here he is on ESPN.
Not to say it's in our favor, but stadium is our favor. You know, stadium is us. That helps us. I don't care what nobody says. This is the most dopest feeling I've ever had. Like, we're having two back-to-back playoff games home. Like, come on now. Like, we get to leave and go eat wings.
It's also time for us to leave and go eat wings. This show comes from the team behind Here and Now, from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Lynn Menegon, James Mastromarino, and Gabrielle Healy. Today's editors were Todd Munt, Micaela Rodriguez, and Kat Welch. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto and Caleb Green. Mike Moschetto also wrote our theme music, along with Max Liebman and me, Chris Bentley. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin, and the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening to Here and Now Anytime. We hope you have a great weekend, and we'll be back with you on Monday.
The economy right now is bewildering, impenetrable, inconceivable.
Not when you have the Indicator podcast in your ears. In under 10 minutes every day, we simplify the complicated news, like...
How does inflation drop? What the heck is a SPAC? Why are trendy little high-fiber sodas suddenly dominating store shelves?
And more. Listen to The Indicator from Planet Money and NPR.
The Embedded podcast brings you eye-opening reporting.
There's something that hasn't been disclosed yet.
Immersive journalism.
I could smell the smoke. I could smell the dust.
Personal stories.
I was scared. Like, I can't protect you.
We are NPR's home for documentary storytelling. Find Embedded wherever you get your podcasts.
Jasmine Morris here from the StoryCorps podcast. Our latest season is called My Way. Stories of people who found a rhythm all their own and marched to it throughout their lives. Consequences and other people's opinions be damned. You won't believe the courage and audacity in these stories. Hear them on the StoryCorps podcast from NPR.